You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only thing more disappointing than Atlas Shrugged Part 3 is Atlas Shrugged Parts 2 and 1. And by the way, the proper subtitle for Part 3 is not Who is John Galt? It is Atlas Shrugged Part 3, Exposition Dump. Joining me this week via Skype from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
Well, I'm pissed now that you've spoiled it for me. I was going to go see how sucky it was in person at the movie theater. Now I don't have to go.
Didn't Parts 1 and Parts 2 spoil that for you?
Well, a little bit. But I figured that with the final gasp of air expelling from John Aguiloro's body, that he might have been able to make something that resembled a film this time around.
I mean, it resembles a film if the film is heavy on exposition and light on everything else.
And I suppose it's not entirely his fault. It's also the director's fault, the writer's fault, the producer's fault, the assistant director's fault, et cetera, on to the marketing guy.
Also joining us this week, via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
Did you know that in a city like Orlando, where there are about 50 movie theaters within reasonable distance from me, the amount of theaters showing Atlas Shrugged Part 3 is 1?
That speaks all we need to know, I would say. Right,
yeah.
Daniel?
That's more than I thought it would be.
Yep.
At least they have standards in Orlando.
But enough about Atlas Productions. There's other organizations that are being killed by irrationality. It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Seattle-based Mars Hill Church is basically closing after its founding pastor called women homes for God's penis. As bad as that sounds, it's actually much worse. Megachurch pastor Mark Driscoll is under fire after he supposedly wrote in a blog in 2001, "The first thing to know you need to know about your penis is that despite the way you may see it, it is not your penis. Ultimately, God created you, and it is his penis. You are simply borrowing it for a while." It goes on. "While his, capital, penis is on loan, you must admit that it is sort of just hanging out there very lonely, as if it needed a home, sort of like a man wandering the streets looking for a house to live in." These men just wander the streets looking for homes to live in.
Do you know the type of people that wander the streets looking for homes to live in?
Vagrants. There you go.
Can you imagine, like, it? Is this saying all virgin penises are like homeless people?
Apparently.
They think
all
the world is ending?
Wearing sandwich boards saying eat it, Joe's. His post continues, and this is where it gets oh so delicious. "Knowing that, capital, his penis would need a home, God created a woman to be your wife, and when you marry her and look down, you will notice that your wife is shaped differently than you and makes a very nice home." So that got him in some trouble, more so than his wearing a shark tooth necklace, considering that that fossil wouldn't have been around when he thinks the Earth was created. And his church has basically had to fire about 40% of its employees and has lost, coincidentally, about 40% of its congregation.
40%, right?
Yes.
So let's just assume for a second that 40% is women, because we know women are 50% of the population. Even if we accept that, which it's probably not, it's probably some men too, but that still means that 10% of women were like, yeah, that makes sense. My vagina is a house. There's parking in the rear.
I was going to make a joke about that. Good anticipating. This is ridiculous, but is it any more ridiculous than anything else that's said in any religious text?
All I know is when you know, this is the only pastors can make the discussion of the penis so uninteresting to me. All I'm gonna say.
I think what's particularly bad about this is his response, which has basically been to say that the media is blowing this out of proportion.
Blowing. Phrasing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And here's my favorite quote of his. He says, "I'm particularly sorry that any of my past actions or decisions have brought distraction to the mission of Mars Hill Church and therefore to those who call this church their home."
So do they call their church a vagina?
Exactly. For all of you who thought of this as your big flappy vulva, I'm sorry.
I mean,
the Patch Adams.
The reason he thinks the media is blown out of proportion is this is one of the things that people don't understand about Christianity when they're like, oh, it's not an issue, Christianity's fine, blah, blah, blah. They literally believe your life does not belong to you.
Yes.
Your entire self does not belong to you. It belongs to God. And they hide that premise. This guy is just being upfront about the premise, so say what you will about him. He's upfront about what he believes.
It's true. And I wonder how far you can take this logic, though. So if your penis is God's and the vagina is the home, is your right hand just like a rental unit? Or is it like a tent? Or what are you doing with it?
Well,
is that God's? And then is it God's butthole, you know, for in the gay situation?
No, butts are home for God's beads.
Oh. All right. That went to a place I didn't expect.
Which is also what he and she said.
Speaking of the unexpected, Django
the Spanish Inquisition?
No one expects it. Django Unchained actress Danielle Watts and her companion, also known as her husband, I think. I don't know why this article used the word companion. Were detained in Los Angeles by the LAPD after an apparent indecent exposure incident. Now, Danielle Watts wrote on Facebook that she was detained for, quote, kissing her white boyfriend. Turns out there's a little update to this story. The police were called by a nearby office building. In fact, the nearby office being the Directors Guild, that vast bastion of liberal, open-minded people, because apparently they thought she and her boyfriend were having sex in the car in the parking lot.
So there's not really anything to add to that.
So there are two elements to this story that I find interesting. One is that I didn't know who this woman was. No, that's not it. The first is that she immediately claimed racism, which I think is interesting. In fact, she told one of the officers, "I bet there's at least one person up there," meaning in the Directors Guild building, "who's a racist. I bet you're a little bit racist." Because everyone's a little bit racist.
And didn't the boyfriend claim that that people only assumed it was prostitution because she's black and he's white?
Yes.
But
yes.
I have a different explanation.
Oh, okay.
I think if people assumed it was prostitution because neither of them looked like anyone who would have sex without money being involved.
If you do see the pictures of them, they are not entirely, well, let's just say attractive individuals.
There's no way, from the pictures, we can't disprove that neither of them uses meth.
Her earrings alone are, oh, wow. And she's wearing a shirt that looks like it has been drawn on with marker. So
I'd like to point out that I am taking the high road here. I'm not making race comments. I am making appearance comments.
Yeah, it's new for you. It's new for the podcast. I know what we're going to do. The reason this was so escalated is that she refused to show ID and then she stormed off. And so the police went and brought her back and she was put in handcuffs, which is probably excessive, which I think is part of the reason why this has gotten so much attention. And there is
the other reason it is because they put someone from Django Unchained in handcuffs. That's just funny.
I don't know if it's so much funny for her, but
not for her at all, but for me, it's very funny.
But this is the thing that we didn't hear with her update, right? Apparently, one of the executives from the building, who was later just described as a guy in a suit in this article, came out of the building
and asked...
That's
what all white guys are. We're just guys in suits.
And asked them to stop. He said, there are people trying to work. Could you please stop putting on a show? And she apparently...
The Directors Guild said that, by the way.
There are so many deep ironies in this story. Apparently, she did not listen, and they continued, and so then they called the police to investigate. So there are many levels of this story. First of all, why are you trying to get them to stop? They're just having sex in public. Does anyone really care? Were their children present? Whatever.
Of course they're exhibitionists. She's an actress.
It's true. It's true. And he is, I don't know what he is. He looks like a retarded executive chef.
He does look like he has some sort of gi on for a karate tournament or something.
Yeah. He looks like he has been inbred for 6 or 7 generations. I don't really know what's up with him. So, all in all, funny and not racist, so get over it.
Well, yeah, I just want to say one more thing about this story. Usually, if you're not doing anything wrong and the police talk to you and you just talk to them calmly and give your ID, then it's fine. Then again, I'm white, so what do I know? Maybe that's white privilege talking, which is probably the response to what I just said. You don't know what it's like to be black. You're right, I don't. Sorry.
But you do know what it's like to be Italian. Speaking of people that other people want to see in handcuffs, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell is in a lot of trouble lately because of all these terrible NFL stories coming out, not the least of which is the newest one of Adrian Peterson potentially beating his son with a switch, although that's probably the most violent way of saying it. During his 8 years at the NFL, the New York Times reports, Goodell has deflected many crises that has threatened the league's integrity and public image, from player misconduct to team misconduct, and they specifically mentioned team spying, Justin.
He blew everyone's eardrums out, but it was totally worth it.
He has survived them all, but now the criticism has reached a boiling point. Women's groups have called for Goodell's resignation or removal because of his handling of the Ray Rice incident. Ray Rice is a running back who was recently shown to punch his girlfriend in an elevator, for which he initially received only a 2-game suspension. But once the video came out, he was indefinitely suspended from the league. So what do you think? Goodell, should he stay? Should he go? Should he get a raise?
Get a raise?
I don't know. That's an option, I suppose.
Is it? Well, he'll just fine players more for hits that aren't illegal, that they call illegal.
Hits that aren't illegal.
How many goddamn times are they going to throw a flag this season when something good happens to call shit back and then fine people for it to legitimize it?
Yeah, like the Jets touchdown against the Giants, which was hysterical. Do you see that one? Not to get off on a tangent, but Geno Smith throws a touchdown pass, and the refs called it back because a coach on the sideline who wasn't legally allowed to call a timeout called a timeout, and they recognized it as a timeout anyway.
Oh, the Jets. See, we can make fun of them now because the Patriots have won a game.
Yes, we're allowed. So anyway, I think the Ray Rice issue is probably the biggest thing. Adrian Peterson was recently indicted. He's a star running back in the NFL for taking what he called a switch to his child's behind and giving him a whooping.
Right, and the only reason he was deactivated by his team was it happened right after the Ray Rice thing. So they were kind of like, we have to. Just like Greg Hardy for the Panthers, they initially didn't deactivate him, and then they decided to because of the social pressure, basically.
Yeah, but I think the biggest scandal, of course, is Ray Rice and him knocking his wife the fuck out in an elevator.
That was one hell of a punch.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a Marvel punch. It's the kind of punch you only see in Marvel movies. Like the one punch across the face that knocks the person out.
Yeah, it was.
Well, to be fair, it was a professional running back and a woman. I mean, he probably has a lot more strength than she does.
Yeah, and part of the controversy is, of course, that she is sort of standing by him and saying, you know, I initiated the fight. Which, if you watch, she did hit him first. So, yeah. I mean, according to terrible objectivist logic, she initiated force, and therefore he had the right to annihilate her.
There are other ways to protect yourself, though, than knocking someone the fuck out. No, I understand that. I'm not.
I was going to make a Ray Rice joke, but you already know the punchline.
That was good.
Thank you.
I've been searching for a joke for the past week and a half about, you know, how people say, like, white on rice. Mm. I've been trying to come up with something about rice on rice, but I can't find it.
You can find the punchline.
Very yes, nice. Exactly. Thank you. That was my offensive joke of the podcast.
No, that was very good. That was probably the best joke we might have ever had on this podcast. So.
Oh, fuck. We should cancel ourselves. Anyway, moving on, much like the NFL should do. No, just go ahead. What were you going to say?
What was I going to say about this whole thing?
Yeah.
Or I was going to say about the force part is, if you know you're that much stronger than someone, you can just incapacitate them in other ways besides knocking them out, you know? Just grab them in a bear hug or something, you know, to stop them from scoring a touchdown. Luke Coakley on Rob Gronkowski. That
Still
type
bitter.
Deal. I'm always going to be bitter about that. No, I mean, look, I'm just going to make an anti-Ravens comment now. With the way the Ravens mug receivers on the field, is this really a surprise?
Oh, gollop and thrown. We have some listeners from Baltimore, or at least who have Baltimore affiliation, so we're going to be getting some hate tweets about that, I feel.
If you're associated with Baltimore, fuck you, all right?
You're going to alienate one-third of our audience right now.
Oh, I thought you meant one city. I was like, okay, it's Baltimore.
No, I can literally think of three people who listen to the podcast.
Oh, really? Are yes. they Ravens fans? Oh, this is going to get good.
Yeah. Anyway, no. So here's the thing. Ray Rice clearly did a bad thing.
A very bad thing.
Yes, clearly did a very bad thing. But we are in a current witch hunt culture where we want to find something that we can sort of all agree is bad. And I think this partially comes from the fact that we're not allowed to judge in most areas of our life. So when there's one area where it's completely crystal clear, we're like, yes, judge him quick. Burn the witch! And we all sort of really overreact, and then we can point to the guy next to him, being Roger Goodell, and going, look! Another witch! He hid the first witch! Burn that witch too! Because it makes us feel good about ourselves.
Don't you think there's a little bit of trying to destroy the good here, though? People wanting to tear down the NFL because it's so popular? I mean, even despite this, the Ravens-Steelers game got 20.8 million viewers.
I definitely think there's a part of that in it. A lot of it has to do with the fact that the NFL is the last bastion, and I'm going to say this and it's going to be semi-controversial, the last bastion of being able to show masculinity left in mainstream culture.
Well, yeah, and they're trying to get rid of that too by all the rules, right? You can only hit people in the strike zone now. If you like lower your helmet a little bit, even if you don't make helmet-to-helmet contact, it's illegal for leading with the helmet. It's just all the rules are taking that out of the game, but that's part of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I agree with that, definitely. So, in another NFL news, we're doing a little bit of an NFL roundup here to quickly move through it. RG3, who is now being called RG Knee, he is the quarterback for the Washington, dare I say it, Redskins, and he injured his foot in the game recently. This marks another significant injury in a career that has been plagued with injuries.
He dislocated his ankle, right?
Yes, it looks like it may not be as bad as it initially looked, because I saw it on live TV and it looked fucking horrific.
How is a dislocation not as bad as a dislocation?
Well, they can pop it back into place, and if there's not any nerve damage, then he might be able to play.
He can probably play better with nerve damage, because then he won't feel all the shit he does to his legs.
He takes some pretty risky jumps, but man, he landed on it and it did that thing where it goes like perpendicular to your leg, and you go, that's not how the foot is supposed to move.
Right, football there. Talk for a second here, right? Let's, you know, social pressure,
bring it in.
Blah, blah,
bring
football
it in.
Talk. Bring it in. Bring in the huddle, right?
Yeah.
This is why mobile quarterbacks will never survive. This is why the NFL is a pocket-passing league. The people defending are too athletic. If you try and scramble and get away from them, the odds are you're going to get hurt. Because you're going to try, as you said, jump away from them, land funny, or they're going to hit you really badly. That happens enough to pocket quarterbacks, pocket passing quarterbacks. So you have these mobile quarterbacks, and they don't work. That's why.
All right. break. So the reason this is a story at all is he is one of the most publicized, we'll say, quarterbacks in the NFL.
He's not even the best quarterback on his team.
I happen to agree with you, but that's because, like you, I am just a wild racist. No, I mean, the thing is, he is a decent quarterback, and he showed some impressive stuff in a few games, but really, he's insanely smart.
He's very well-spoken.
He's very well-spoken. He is just a brilliant communicator, and he's black, which is, while not a minority in the NFL, a minority at the quarterback position, and there's been a lot of talk the past few years about equality in that position, why there aren't more black quarterbacks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he is a PR quarterback in many ways, and the fact that he's continually injured is not a good thing for that team, especially a team like the Redskins, who could use some good publicity.
Just put in Kirk Cousins and be done with it.
Oh, I suppose some wins would be some good publicity. Isn't that the whitest name of a backup quarterback?
I know, that's why it's ridiculous. You can't write this stuff, right?
His name is Kirk Cousins. It just evokes inbreeding and rednecks and hillbillies.
That's why you play football.
It's just amazing how those things happen. But finally, to round out the football roundup here, a familiar face to some of you may be heading up the NFL soon, at least if some people have their way, Condoleezza Rice.
Talk That's about right. a rice-on-rice crime. Yes, I got it! Yes!
Thank you.
Yes!
Yes. So, yes, the former Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, who is apparently a rabid football fan and an encyclopedia of sports knowledge, and also a very, very devoted Browns fan, is being pushed as the next NFL commissioner, especially as Goodell is being sort of bullied into resigning, even though I don't think he will. Many people, including Karl Rove and other high-ranking political officials, and including what's her name, Kristen Gillibrand, Democrat senator from New York, have all said that Rice should be the next NFL commissioner.
Isn't the Democrat saying that because they just don't want her to run for office?
It's true. She's also a killer piano player. Is there nothing this woman can't do? She can play the piano. She can talk sports. She can bomb your country. She can listen to your phone calls as the head of the NSA. She's the Wonder Woman. Yeah.
Damn Zack Snyder for not casting her.
Also, she's smoking hot. Okay, not really. But Elliot, do you have any thoughts on Condoleezza Rice taking over all of football, becoming the queen of football, the empress of the NFL?
Oh, are you guys still talking about sports? Sorry about that. No, I'm on Grindr right now, so, you know, just let me know when you're done. No.
You're such a stereotype.
No, Condoleezza Rice can do whatever
she wants. Wrote you? They should be canceled or fired.
Condoleezza Rice can do whatever she wants. She's brilliant, so she can do whatever she wants. If she wants to take over, I think she'd run it really well.
She would, except this picture where she looks like the devil and she's holding up her fingers about an inch, which makes her look like an evil referee of some sort. Anyway.
I'm just confused as to how she's a Browns fan.
There are still some out there.
I'm sorry?
Exactly.
So it's the fall. Football has come back. That's why we're going to talk about it a lot on the podcast. You know what else comes back in the fall? TV. We talk about how the networks are promoting their fall seasons next in TV with JMF. Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off. In the last season when I wasn't focused on. We're in the middle of the season of Doctor Who, so let's continue our analysis of this season with the latest episode, Listen. What'd you guys think?
I think I'm going to let Elliot start here, because, again, as a newbie, and I'm not going to continually beat this horse until it's dead, although I'm going to beat it until it's pretty close to dead. I'd like to hear an expert analysis first, and then I'll give you my completely uninformed, completely top-level surface opinion.
just to defend you for a second before Elliot goes, whoever said that and sent that message or whatever, I think it's very valuable for the podcast to have a novice Whovian in here. Yeah. Because it helps everyone learn about Doctor Who. So it's not just like people nerding out who know a lot about it. All right? So whoever wrote that message, fuck off.
Is
so
that
there
a
we
real
go.
Message?
Now I've lost four listeners, okay?
Wait a minute. Is that a real message? I was just making fun of myself. Fuck you people. I'll give you any kind of analysis I want.
Oh, I thought it was a real message.
No. I was just making fun of myself.
So but fuck you.
All you people out there, fuck you.
Fuck you, hypothetical viewer. And hey, Dan, fuck you for making me look like an idiot.
You know, you'll edit that in post. It'll be fine.
No, I'm leaving that in. That's funny.
Oh, God. All right, Elliot, let's go.
I loved it, man. I love this episode. I think this is the first episode of this with Capaldi and with the new Doctor that I really loved. You know, anytime the Doctor interacts with children, I love it. And I think that this really, I read a very interesting article about Doctor Who, because there's other people who are doing their analysis as well, and I like to read them. And one of them was making the point that, Moffat tends to, he doesn't really focus so much on villains, and that there are actually a few times where there really isn't a villain at all. It's more about the relationship between the Doctor and the companions, or the Doctor and the human race. And this is one of those episodes. There's really not a villain per se in this one. This was a little bit more about the Doctor's relationship with himself and with his sanity. Because one of the first questions that she asks when she sees him is, how long have you been traveling by yourself? So it was a really good psychological look at it, but it was also a really good way to kind of remind people that Clara, you know, her connection with kids and her connection, her ability to reach out to people in a human way that the Doctor doesn't quite have yet. And how it was just really, really good. I liked it a lot.
It was the most Moffat-y Moffat ever.
Yes! Yes!
Little Mr. Moffat. Sat on his Moffat.
I love when Moffat goes full Moffat, because people get so mad when he goes kind of Moffat, and I'm like, no, this is pretty good. And then you have an episode like this, and you're like, yes, yes,
yes.
Yeah, Grand Moffat Tarkin.
It was awesome.
Star Wars joke. Are we ready? Should I go? Am I ready?
Mm-hmm.
It was really good.
That's insightful.
Thank you. So, yeah, this was an episode of TV, unlike many of them, in the sense that I actually felt emotion. I know that makes me sound a little bit like a robot, but...
You have Randroid.
Thank you. No, I mean, I have felt emotions before, thank you very much, and I thoroughly enjoy emotion a lot. But my point is that a lot of TV doesn't evoke strong emotion. Sometimes movies do a little bit better. Maybe that's mainly just because it's all enormous and you're sort of overwhelmed with your senses. But from the very beginning, from everything that was being said, from the way it was shot, from the facial expressions of the actors and the dialogue, I was fully emotionally invested in this episode. I was fearful. I was a little bit ennui. I was full out completely scared at one point, especially during the really intense scene at the window with Rufus, Rupert, Rubles, little black kid. What's his name?
Rupert
Pink, that kid. And the Doctor and Clara and whatever the hell that was behind them. It was very intense and very well done. Just in terms of a standalone piece of art, it was top notch, like 10 out of 10 stars in terms of just what it was trying to accomplish and then how it accomplished it.
Yeah, the directing was phenomenal. Everything that was done with the camera was intentional and had a point. the thing I loved about it was the framing, even in the conversations when Clara was on the date with Danny Pink, they always made it look like someone was, they were hovering over each other. They were there. Because the whole episode was supposed to be like, who was watching, right? Who's always listening? So they always made it look like, you know, you were following them. You know, when they showed the Doctor and Clara going into the house where little Rupert was living, it looked like we were following them. And whenever anyone was having a conversation, it looked like the other person was following them. So usually the framing of conversations is very sort of conventional, and that's just what you're supposed to do. But they found a way to make it work directorially with the theme.
Yeah, very much so. A lot of the camera work was very creative. There was a, especially the scene where it stood out to me was where he was talking to the keeper of the children's house about the coffee and,
yes,
and the TV and whatnot. And so there's two quick pans in that scene. One is quick where it shows Clara going up the stairs unbeknownst to the doctor, sort of over his shoulder. And the other then is the quick pan where he looks at the TV and the doctor disappears. Just tremendously well done in terms of camera work and directing and the point it was making in the story, and then the humor in revealing the next scene with the doctor and the coffee cup. It was so well planned. The entire episode was so well planned.
What do you think of that, Elliot, that the doctor stole somebody's coffee?
He's probably a little thirsty.
So you don't have a problem with it? Because I can see some people saying, well, why should the doctor steal stuff from people? That's just Moffat abusing the character.
No, I always look at the doctor as somebody who's always interested in other facets of human life, you know, and maybe this doctor, he's still trying out his new body. Maybe his taste buds are a little different. So, you know, he might be trying the coffee. See if his new taste buds like coffee.
And that's a cup of coffee. That's fine. Mm. There are more. Mm. And, but that's an interesting point, Elliot, because I don't have a history with the doctor, as people very well know by this point. But I really liked in this episode that he was very inquisitive and almost philosophical, but he wasn't, I'll just say, I guess he wasn't rationalistic, meaning he looked out into the world for mm-hmm. the answers to these questions. It wasn't a matter of supernatural, or it wasn't a matter of, I don't know, something. Well, he looked for evidence, and he looked for what was really going on. What was the explanation of this thing? And he said at the very end, sort of before he got knocked out, like, I must know, or I have to know.
Well, yeah, like, and that's that. Moffat's approach to Doctor Who, and that's why one of the reasons I love Moffat so much is there was a quote from Matt Smith's run where he said, that's something that doesn't make sense. Let's go and poke it with a stick.
Yeah.
And Moffat brought that back again. He said the idea for this episode spawned from, well, what would the doctor do if he was bored and had nothing to do? And he said, well, he'd find something and he'd poke it with a stick. And that's what he did.
Yeah. The episode opening up with a sort of quasi-deep philosophical question about evolution and traits and biology mixing with a little bit of psychology. That was fascinating. That's not something that you see very often in television.
But the brilliance of the theme, of the resolution, fear is the constant companion, you know? The idea that the doctor traveling alone on the TARDIS, is he really alone? No, he always travels with a fear of some kind. The idea that the doctor is afraid, that the doctor is fearful, I mean, that's a really, really, really deep thing to bring to the screen, you know, especially so early on for a new doctor. But it makes sense because he's still getting attached to his new surroundings. This is not an episode that Russell T. Davies could have written. He couldn't have done it. It would not have been nearly as brilliant because it's just not his sense of life. It was just not how he would have run the series. And I think
many writers could have written this episode. That's what makes Moffat such a good writer.
Yeah. It's got to be him. It was his sense of life all the way through. It starts off with a terror outside the door, and it ends, you know, with a young woman talking to a scared little boy and giving him courage. And, you know, it brilliant, just brilliant.
Right, and that's what I love about Moffat is in everything he does, everything is connected, and it's all integrated. And with this, the thing I love about it is it's not only that the fear is his constant companion, it's literally... that's why he has companions. not just with this doctor, because every doctor is a different incarnation, but they just represent a different facet of the doctor that he's dealing with.
Yeah.
Well, now we know he's always had this fear, which is why he has companions with him, because he doesn't want to be alone. And he wants to feel like he has validity. And having a companion who he can impress and dazzle does that.
Yep. Brilliant. It was just, I just adored it. But I'm finally really excited now for the new season of Who. I know it's 4 episodes in, but I'm finally really engaged, where it took me a while.
Yeah, I mean, this was the first episode that I was really blown away by. The previous ones were okay, and I think Capaldi's just an extraordinary actor. But this one, as an integrated show, where I enjoyed every element of it, was the first one that I got really excited about.
Let me ask about something though, because this is something we saw for the first time ever, from what I've heard. The young doctor. Is this as epic as I think it was?
Oh, see, I had no context for me. I mean, I was genuinely surprised when, you know, Clara's under the bed and we're really tight on her face, which again, about this episode, a lot of good facial camera work, allowing the actors to act, not a lot of quick cuts.
A lot of good facial camera work?
Oh, Jesus.
You were
yes,
there.
Justin. A lot of bukkake camera work.
By the way, while we're making sexual comments, I really enjoyed the line where she looked at herself and was like, was that what I look like from behind? And the doctor said something and he was like, yeah, you know, don't worry about it. And she was like, well, actually, I thought it was quite good. Just to show someone with that kind of self-confidence, I was like, well done, Moffat. That's one of the reasons I really like you.
That was good. He had some good jokes about her facial features, too. She needs 3 mirrors. Yeah, I liked that one.
Yeah, that was good.
But when we were close on her face and we were listening to the whoever was the older people talk to the boy, and then all of a sudden he says something about, well, he's never going to make it as a Time Lord. I like sat up in my chair and I was like, what? That was genuine surprise for me because did not see that coming. But then the resolution of that with her and the physical resolution of her actually enacting this dream with him was just outstanding.
But you
use that word a lot. But
you haven't seen any of the original of any of the of Who before this?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I honestly don't even know about the early stuff before 2005.
But the context though in terms of Clara, when you figure out the season prior, when you find out who she is and why he calls her the Impossible Girl and what she has done to save the doctor and it's very fascinating how she's woven into the doctor's timeline in into his life in so many ways. And not just because of how she managed to save his life, in the episode called The Name of the Doctor, but it's fascinating. You know, she keeps coming back into his life in these different ways, in these different forms. You know, it's really, really cool.
What about this mythological stuff, though? Because I don't know the past. Not knowing this stuff, what was all the stuff they were talking about how you become a Time Lord and everything? I thought that was the species, but now you have to go through training and everything? What is that? Is that something that's going to be introduced later, or is that already established in the mythology?
As I recall, the Time Lords are a race of people, but they're... You either went and you studied and you learned and you became a collegiate, academically minded one, or you fought, like if you were fighting in the Time War. So I really don't know too much more about it, but they're pretty well established. In the original series, you actually meet other Time Lords.
Yeah, because they talked about the Academy, right?
Yeah. He's never going to go to the Academy, he's not going to be a soldier, or he's not going to be in the Army. It's fascinating, and to think that he becomes a doctor, that's very, very fascinating.
So are we going to see a prequel spinoff here where it's like the Harry Potter years of Doctor Who?
That would be so cool.
As long as Peter Capaldi still plays the main character.
I don't know if they can make that work.
We have the technology, man. We can make it.
All right, speaking of other things we haven't seen, MTV's Faking It is doing something that's never been done in television before. This article,
a quality reality show?
No, it's not a reality show at all. It's a scripted drama. But this is what this article in the Hollywood Reporter says. MTV's teen comedy Faking It is poised to break new ground on the small screen in its second season when it explores what it's like to be born intersex. And that does not mean in a town called intersex. It means literally being born that way. Intersex is a physical condition that occurs when a person is born with both male and female chromosomes, but their bodies typically develop as female. About one in every 2,000 people are born with intersex traits, and the condition is as common as people with red hair. So they go on to describe these characters, who I have no idea who they are, nor do I care. But basically, there was a cliffhanger at the end of season one, that they ran by MTV, and of course MTV, Minority Television, said, "Do it, we love it." And in the beginning of season two, it's going to be revealed that this person is intersex, and it's going to affect the rest of the show.
So I don't know much about intersex people. But from this article, it doesn't make it seem that there is too much of a consequence on someone's life if they're born intersex. Meaning they have, you know, mixed chromosomes, but what does that manifest as? At least that's not clear from this Hollywood Reporter article. Anyone familiar with this whatsoever?
No, and I don't think Hollywood is really going to give us a clear explanation from it. What I think this is an example of is naturalism and how it's taken over Hollywood.
Well, there's definitely that, yeah.
Because all this is doing is saying, what determines the plot? Well, her biology. That's what makes this interesting. Right? He does say at one point, the creator, part of the overall theme of Faking It is how hard it is to be your authentic self and how important it is to strive to do that. Now, granted, we haven't watched the show, so we don't know what it's like, but when you're making your entire plot about how this person is born, that's not about any sort of authentic self. There's no development of the self in there. It's just saying, you're born this way, that's who you are, figure out how to deal with it.
Right. I mean, it's just not, it's not consequential to me, meaning it's not something that I would sit down and care about. I mean, if there was some sort of passing reference about this person being intersex, but it didn't drive the plot, it wasn't the sole focus of the show, if they were an interesting character otherwise, then I wouldn't care at all. Like, it would be fine.
Right, but and this is the same discussion as, is Daryl gay or not, because of the prevalence of naturalism. People care more about that than the choices these characters make.
Right.
It just sounds like if they had gone a more different route, like, I don't mind them doing an intersex storyline, but if they had started with the idea that maybe she was noticing some physical changes in her body, she didn't know what they were, and she goes through the process of investigating.
So doctor. She becomes Spider-Man?
Well, that'd be awesome.
Spider-Woman.
The idea that she discovers that the end result of her search is that she's intersex, and then once you reach that conclusion, you know, they tell what it is and all stuff, and then you move on to another story. Then I wouldn't have a problem with that. But it looks like, just from what I'm reading, it sounds like she kind of already knows what she is, and she's already taking, like, pills and stuff for it.
Right,
so
they actually asked how it would affect the story, and he said it doesn't affect just the story, it affects the entire series, the rest of the series.
But then they don't tell that story. She's already there. Why not tell the story of how she discovers it?
Because that would be dealing with her choice of how she deals with it.
Yeah, this is much more...
But isn't that what you want?
Oh, I mean, no, we're not arguing with you saying that that wouldn't be much better. We're just saying that that's not what they're going to do. Because they're looking at this as almost... They're trying to make it as documentary-like as possible.
So you're saying their naturalism versus our... natural inclination for a more romantic storyline.
Yeah, mine's not definitely a natural inclination. Mine is an explicit and very practiced.
Touché.
But yes, that is what we're saying.
And I don't know. It's just not something that I find compelling in the same way that I don't find it compelling when they just have to throw out a gay character, you know, male or female,
Daryl.
And make that the entire purpose and being of the character. I don't know. No, choices are so much more interesting to me than biology.
Right, and that's what Elliot was just saying, was how they learn about it and how they choose to discover it. That would be much more interesting.
Right.
But really, this is even actually even worse if you think about it from a second, from that standpoint. If you're already talking about, as Elliot said, it's uninteresting because that person's already there. They already know they're that way and they're dealing with it. Well, then who is the story about dealing with it? It's about the other people dealing with it. So we see very easily how naturalism transitions into caring more about other people than yourself, a.k.a. secondhandedness.
Be about acceptance.
Ooh, sneaky. The bigoted people who can't accept her for showing no outward signs of anything.
Exactly. But when do we get to this trend where, I mean, and I'm probably going to be a little controversial here myself, but we've gotten into this trend
where. When did we start qualifying on this podcast?
I know, right? Yeah, we should forget that. But we got this trend in high school shows because, you know, occasionally I might watch one or 20, but, You watch
You're
them
so
and
gay.
Acceptance keeps coming back out, you know, and to see that all kids just want to be accepted. They just want to be accepted. They want to be part of a group. And I mean, I guess that might kind of be true, but kids want more than that. Like kids want to dominate. Like kids want to, they want to move up social ladders and they want to make money and they want to, you know, travel and they want to do a lot of things. And I'm just getting a little fed up with a lot of these teen shows where, you know, we're just describing the typical high school life. I'm getting fed up.
Like, I love how on your list of things kids care about is traveling.
Oh yeah. I think kids care about traveling a lot.
Yeah. I mean, to bolster Elliot's point here, I think we're missing the acceptance for the trees. And what I mean is it's not necessarily acceptance as the primary thing that these kids are dealing with at that age. It's more so identity. Yes. Trying to figure out who they are and where they fit. And yes, society is a part of that and their friends are a part of that and culture is a part of that. But what about where they fit as, you know, the individual they want to be and their values and their goals? But the problem is we de-emphasize all those things and continually push acceptance and falling in line and being part of a group and
collectively
point we don't care anymore, especially in art.
Right,
to Justin's point,
what they're missing is when you figure out some part about yourself that you really like and then no one accepts you for it, that's the confusing part. And it's not dealing with, as you guys are saying, the individual's journey to struggle with and say, well, I don't need that acceptance ultimately because I know I really like this. It becomes about forcing the other people to accept it.
Well, I think a lot of showrunners are trying to create high school characters and high school shows to be role models for actual young people, you know, to emulate. And I'm more interested in doing a show where with a more villainous or screwed up high school kid that, you know, a high school version of Walter White, I guess you could say. And that is specifically not to emulate, but that you'll watch because it's compelling.
Well, I don't know about you, but I want to be like Finn from Glee.
Oh, rest in peace.
Too soon?
Too soon.
Well, I think we can safely say that we're not going crazy because the networks are having trouble marketing all this stuff we're talking about. In an article on Variety, they're talking about how the networks are using unique methods to entice viewers to watch fall shows. I'm going to read from the article.
Is it unique methods like an interesting story?
And that's what we'll get to in 2 seconds here. That's the point I was going to build
okay.
to. Thank you
okay.
for blowing the load on my...
That's for no parking in the rear earlier.
To get viewers roused about a series set to launch this fall, NBC opened a door to the future, letting select TV aficionados don a trendy Oculus Rift virtual reality headset and pretend they were on the set of the program itself. The show? The Voice. Maybe you've heard of it. As radical changes in TV viewing habits transform the business, networks are altering the playbook they use to promote their shows. They're emphasizing not just new shows, but returning programs as well. They're working up strategies to reach viewers who skip live airings of their shows, and they're experimenting with methods that acknowledge a good chunk of potential viewers need to be reached through means other than TV. So they go on and they talk about all the different stuff. They talk about how the Big Bang was used to promote Thursday Night Football, because really, that's how you get people to watch football, use the Big Bang Theory. They talk about how the Blacklist has this strange campaign. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but they have a bunch of pictures of the James Spader as if he's on different magazine covers, and I guess they put that on the back of magazines. But it's also on posters everywhere and at, like, bus stops. So you randomly see, like, a Times magazine cover with James Spader on it for some reason. But I think the most telling quote from this entire article is as follows. The networks are even more aware of new dynamics when it comes to their freshman crop of shows, about 80% of which are likely to fail. This is my thing. Why are we talking about marketing if 80% of new fails are showing, are failing? Doesn't that say something about how you're creating these shows and your process for it?
You would think so, wouldn't you?
That's a remarkably high failure rate. I'm not sure what other business sustains on only 20% of your product being bought. That's crazy.
Do you think it's just the model they use, that they just throw everything against the wall and hope something sticks and makes a lot of money, like Lost? Or is it because of all the competition now with the other means of distribution?
But here's the thing about that. The competition is a dual-edged sword, right? So on one hand, there is more competition. But on the other hand, we see that you don't need as massive an audience to be successful and make money. Sure, mm-hmm. A show like Lost is going to make mega bucks. But a show like Girls, for instance, which pulls in less than a one share regularly, still makes a lot of money for HBO and is successful because the audience that watches it is devoted to it. So, yes, I think partially it's that their model is terrible. They completely need to revamp. And I think, fortunately, places like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon are sort of forcing them, or at least will force them in the next few years, to really rethink the way they do this.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm talking about, is it's kind of the major studio mentality, where with movies now, everyone wants the big tentpole franchises. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with television. That's why I brought up A Lost. People want the next big hit. They don't just want, like, a little show that makes decent money, but not a lot.
Right. And the problem is, that is such an outdated model. We're talking about the same model that viewed Dukes of Hazzard as a wild success because it brought in bigger ratings than any show in history. But why is that? Because there were only three goddamn shows on television at that time.
Right. The model before was based upon lack of competition. But now, right. If the model with so much competition, the only way to win it is to have the best quality. And they haven't switched to trying to make quality. They just switched to continue to try and corner the market with more NCIS.
Well, the other thing also is that you're still dealing with the Nielsen ratings. You're still dealing with broadcast networks that are kind of under a stranglehold under the FCC in a way.
Yes.
You know, when you have online content that is not that strangled by those kind of regulations, where you can say things like fuck and shit, and you can show boobs and penises and stuff like that. You know, that sort of thing. Not that you're required to have those for good storytelling, but at the very least, you know, you feel like you're watching something that's been a little more genuine, I guess. I don't think that's the right word. But it's too much interference, I think, when it comes to broadcast television.
Right, when you feel like the artist is being forced to limit himself based upon arbitrary rules, it makes you not respect the product as much.
Exactly. And I think that's what's going on. I mean, NBC, I mean, a storyline like, you don't think, does anybody honestly think Breaking Bad would have lasted on NBC?
No,
does anything last on NBC?
Yeah, I mean, even Hannibal's barely lasting on NBC. I mean, what you say is well taken. That's why nobody likes the Big Bang Theory, because it's become stagnant, because they just do the same thing over and over again because they can't go anywhere.
It's a cash cow. If they try to take it anywhere, they risk losing all that money. Right. Whereas on cable, on online streaming, other things, you have the opportunity to be a little more cutting edge.
Yeah, if you think about it in the same context that how central planning works, and maybe if history buffs think back to FDR, for instance,
once they sort of found something that worked, like the Big Bang Theory or whatever show it is, then they immediately strangle it and say, it works, so stop innovating, stop doing anything new or interesting, just continue to do what you're doing, and hopefully this will continue in perpetuity to be the thing that makes us money.
Right, and I think it was Carlton Cuse who said that recently, that, yeah, it was a wrap-up article about Lost I was reading, of course, where he said that what made Lost unique was the network model used to be find something that works and run it into the ground until no one wants to watch it anymore. Lost was the first show that negotiated an endpoint.
It's true. Shitty endpoint, but the point is taken. Mm-hmm. And say what you will about the newest season of Arrested Development, but Netflix basically just said, hey, do what you gotta do to make this series, and we're not gonna strangle you, and, you know, ratings be what they will, and they made a ton of money off of that, by the way, in terms of new subscriptions.
Alright, I think that about sums up that discussion. So, let's talk about things that are always with us or other people, plus more Lost. So you know what that means. Unresolved questions. Need Yahoo Answers Answers. Just another answer, I won't begin. Just another question. Just another answer, I won't begin. First question. Doctor Who's companion? Question mark. If you could choose any celeb in the world to be the Doctor's companion in Doctor who would you pick? Update. I am like Doctor Who's number one fan. I really love LUV it. I collect magazines, figures, books, and everything! Exclamation point. If I had to choose, I would not know who to choose. Ha ha.
Why did he even? He's what? He spelled it right the second time. Why did he spell it right the first time?
Because a lot of this is just people type and they don't fix what they type. So it was a typo, and they didn't go back.
That would drive me nuts.
He has no time for proofreading. He's too busy buying Doctor Who things.
So how about it? Any celeb in the world to be the Doctor's companion, who would you pick?
I'd pick Malcolm Tucker.
I knew you were going to do that. Wouldn't it just be better to be more literal and just say Peter Capaldi?
Yes, but I want him as Malcolm Tucker. That's the thing. Malcolm Tucker is the very foul-mouthed Scottish communications director in Peter Capaldi's most famous show to date other than this, which is The Thick of It.
You could even take it even further and be like, oh, well, Matt Smith or David Tennant.
Nah. Oh, for you? Fine. You can have whoever you want. Not for me.
No, that's not what I was saying. I was just saying taking that principle. What about you, Elliot?
Oh, God, there's so many. A couple of weeks ago, I would have said Joan Rivers, actually, believe it or not. But, golly. Oh, she would have been hysterical. He'd take her to a planet, and she's like, well, you know that these women are all Jewish because the hair's not wet. I mean, it'd just be fantastic.
That's racist, but awesome.
I don't know, but in terms of people, I guess if people who are alive now, that you'd want to go. Golly. Oh, old school. Don Rickles. I would send Don Rickles on the TARDIS. He would be hysterical.
So you want a stand-up comedian. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I want someone that could either make the Doctor laugh or just completely embarrass him. You know what I mean? Just people who...
Jeffrey Ross.
The companions are always awestruck by whatever planet they go to and whatever monsters they're encountering. And I kind of want somebody that's just going to be like, you know what? Look at it and just kind of go, that's not so interesting.
I have your answer then. And this can only be for Peter Capaldi's Doctor.
Adam Carolla?
Bill Belichick.
What?
Can you imagine him and the Doctor trying to have a conversation?
Doctor would be asking him questions. He goes, I'm focused on the next episode. I'm focused on the next episode. I'm just focused on the next episode. Why are you always wearing the goddamn hoodie? It's not even cold in here. We're on a planet closest to the sun, for fuck's sake. That's Malcolm Tucker. But anyway, Bill Belichick, that's an interesting answer.
All right, next question. What is fear? Is it a weakness? How does one overcome the fear of fear?
Thank you, FDR.
Didn't we learn that fear is a superpower this week?
That may have been why this question was chosen.
Oh, someone's a really good showrunner here.
Yeah, genius behind the wheel.
NBC, did you hear that? Really good showrunner. That means please don't hire me ever.
Please don't ruin my career by hiring me.
I just shot my career in the foot before I got it started.
Is fear... okay, so... fear is an emotion, sort of like any other emotion, which is it happens, and sometimes you don't know why it's happening, sometimes you do know why it's happening, sometimes it's happening appropriately, sometimes it's not. So like other emotions, you have to deal with it with your rational mind. If someone is pointing a gun at your head, there's probably good reason to be afraid. If someone is pointing a squirt gun at your head, probably not, and you should fix that.
Well, what's in the squirt gun?
Water.
Oh, well then, yeah.
What, cat pee?
That's pretty
scary. What do you want me to say?
Well, what if it's acid?
It would melt the squirt gun. Not really. I guess there are some acids that wouldn't. Anyway, shut up. Was that an adequate answer? Do you have something to add?
How does one overcome the fear of fear?
Well, that's stupid.
You just stop being annoying. No, seriously, why are you thinking about it on that level? Just think of what you're afraid of and what you can do to protect yourself from it, right?
Yeah, and are you afraid of something rational? I have still an insanely, basically irrational fear of spiders, although I could make a good case why it's a pretty rational fear.
Because they're fucking gross.
Because the Australian white spider,
for hundreds of years,
was thought to be completely benign, almost like the daddy long leg, has actually evolved into being one of the deadliest spiders on the planet in the past 20 years. Thank you very much. That's why I take the approach of firebomb all spiders, no matter the size or kind. Now how are you going to sleep at night?
Thankfully, that was vague enough that I can sleep at night. But let's just move on to the next question.
Fear itself.
A personality of a stalker? Question mark. A few days ago, someone told me that I have a personality of a stalker. I didn't know what the heck he was talking about until I saw this page. And there's a link to a page here. I have almost all traits mentioned in this page, except stalkers don't display the discomfort or anxiety that people should naturally feel in certain situations. Now, you think I'm a terrible person? I'm really not, and I've never known I have a problem until I saw that page. You think I have a serious problem? Question mark. What should I do about it? Can people really cure from this?
Get off the internet and go play outside.
This is a WebMD question.
Oh, Jesus.
Can we talk about the website itself, though? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I click on it. I do research for this podcast.
I know, I should do it too. But, I mean, I'm looking at it right now. It's just basic HTML. Who the fuck writes this stuff? Like, there's no doctor. There's no sources cited.
Can you read the list?
Yeah, let's see. Stalkers will not take no for an answer. Stalkers display an obsessive personality. Stalkers are above average in intelligence and are usually smarter than the run-of-the-mill person with mental problems. Most stalkers don't have any relationship outside the one they are trying to reestablish or the one they have imagined exists between them and their victim. Stalkers don't display the discomfort or anxiety that people should naturally feel in certain situations, which is the one that our questioner says they don't have. Stalkers often suffer from low self-esteem and feel they must have a relationship with the victim in order to have any self-worth. Few stalkers can see how their actions are hurting others. Stalkers many times have a mean streak and will become violent when frustrated. How violent? Often deadly.
So doesn't this describe Ray Rice?
Yes, it does.
So I'm trying to look at ESIA.net. End stalking in America. So that's it. That's where they're getting this information.
Mrs. Defoe would not accept this as a credible source. I'm just putting that out there right now.
Who's Mrs. Defoe?
My ninth grade English teacher. This would not pass the credible source test.
Well, doesn't it miss, like, the most basic definition of stalker?
Someone who stalks?
Yeah. Doesn't define stalking. You know, all stalkers do these certain things, right?
This is the problem with these types of things. Like, have you ever looked at you probably haven't, Justin, but because I'm neurotic about this, I have looked at, like, those pamphlets, like, are you an alcoholic?
Yeah.
And the questions are like, do you have between 1 and 50 drinks a week? Do you drink with friends or by yourself? Do you drink because you're happy or sad? If you marked yes to one of these questions, you're probably an alcoholic.
And then do you flip the page and it says, find Jesus?
What the fuck?
Sometimes they do.
So stupid. You're not a stalker. You wouldn't be asking if you're a stalker if you're a stalker. Mm-hmm. Go away.
You would be out stalking. You wouldn't be on the internet.
Right, you'd be asking your victim outside her window while you furiously masturbate in a tree.
Am I a stalker? Do you think I'm stalking you?
Exactly. Using your tears as lube.
All right, next question. Lost. Desmond's constant? What would happen if Penny, Desmond's constant, died? Would Desmond just continue to travel back and forward in time?
Have at it, guys, because I have no...
That's actually probably the correct answer to this question.
The show that's been off the air for like 25 years at this point. What would happen if Desmond's constant died? Well, the show would be much less interesting.
Yeah, it would probably, if she died, she'd go in a church with a bunch of people and they'd all like ascend or something.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be purgatory, but it kind of would be, but not really. But a little, but not really.
Factory. Getting to know four other nerd dudes. But maybe that's a different Penny.
And I think Desmond would die of a nosebleed. That's what would really happen.
So Lost would become the Butterfly Effect starring Ashton Kutcher if Penny died.
Yeah. And then what would he yell? Because he couldn't yell, Penny! He'd have to yell like,
yeah, he could. They could just... Damn it, I was going to do the same joke.
Pasta joke for the win.
I was going to say they could just make him work at an Italian restaurant. We're out of pasta. What kind? Penne!
What was Desmond's favorite food? Penne alla vodka. It's a terrible joke.
All right, I think that's all we can say about that, except the fact that he always travels forward in time. We all do.
Or they could replace her with the actress who plays Penny on The Big Bang Theory.
Her new awful haircut. Last question. What social pressures influence your life?
Is that it? No explanation? Mm. Someone who is concise?
Yep, concise to the point and actually kind of interesting.
Wow. Mm. Bravo. You win the internet today.
I found this one on Google. No, I'm just kidding. It was on Yahoo Answers.
Don't break the fourth wall. Interesting. What social pressures? Well, there's clothing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it never made any sense to me that men wore pants and women wore skirts. Not that I have an attraction to skirts, aesthetically speaking. Like, I wouldn't necessarily, especially in the current culture, want to wear one. But doesn't it make more sense that women would wear pants and men would wear skirts or, like, kilts? I think the Scottish got that one right.
Why?
Just imagine for a second, Justin. Just give it,
does it have
four seconds of thought about why men... would prefer to wear something open on the bottom that's more airy and breezy and...
I mean, and I understand what you're saying, but what about the protection element?
Well, you could still wear some sort of protective thing, but and still have, you know, breathability.
So all men are going to have cups on and wear kilts?
Well, in my ideal world, probably Elliot's.
And in God's world, apparently, since after all, the penis is just looking for a home. We don't want to constrain it.
Yeah, it's also looking for a convertible.
Might as well.
I was going for some sort of joke, but that one was better.
That was getting you back for the stealing my Lost joke. I'm going to market this one as the episode where they steal each other's jokes.
So aside from that, there are social norms about clothing that we accept and colors that we accept and things like that.
Colors, huh?
Well, it's true. If I went out in like a full pink suit, I would be looked at differently than if I got a navy blue suit.
I just bought a purple Darkwing Duck t-shirt. Take that.
Okay. Well, one, it's kind of cool. Where'd you get it? Just kidding. But two, purple is okay. Purple is a neutral, unless it's in an upside down triangle. But so that's my answer. You two go now. You two riff on something that makes more sense than what I just said.
Elliot?
Social pressures.
Well, is there anything as a gay man you deal with?
Well, probably, you know, like weight, I guess you could say. I mean, I'm not particularly petite, if that word even applies to guys. So, you know, there's a lot of that, you know, the different diets and the nutritions and the, you know, let's ban Coke, let's ban this, let's ban that and all that. So, all that has made one very grumpy, Elliot, I guess you could say, you know. I mean, everyone's like, oh, let's go to Whole Foods and we'll do this and we'll do that. I'm like, I'm just here for the gluten-free pasta so I can douse it with Alfredo sauce. No, but try this and try that. You can try this chicken that's made from this fungus that grows up in the Andes and that gets shipped down, you know, and it's just, enough with this health food, you know, crap. I get it. It's good to eat healthy, but my gosh. Food purity is like a religion now. So, I mean, that's definitely a social pressure.
You should live in California. Jeez.
Oh, fuck.
No, thank you.
Have you tried this kale milk? This kale milk is to die for.
This rice milk is so delicious. Like, no, shut up.
They make milk out of everything but goddamn milk anymore.
It's not milk, though. It has to come from
a
teat to be milk.
There's no almond boob from which to squeeze the milk. It's juice. It's almond juice. Soy juice.
Yeah. Unless but, it's know, the but... Almond Brothers' mother.
Yeah.
Oh. What a fucking stretch.
That's what they said.
They were milking her.
But you guys get what I'm saying, though, right? Like, you don't notice that? Like, everyone's all trying to talk about nutrition. I'm like, you know, I just want to, you know, I don't want to feel guilty because I have a Krispy Kreme donut or six. I just want to feel, you know. I want to be able to enjoy whatever I'm eating. That's all.
Justin,
danger of becoming a Jim Gaffigan bit.
Why does everyone hate Pop-Tarts? That's not a good Jim Gaffigan, by the way. Don't applaud that. That's a terrible Jim Gaffigan.
I understood what you were doing, though, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Justin and I, here we thought you were going to go somewhere like about heteronormativity and the oppression of the gay man in art and film and you're like, no. Donuts!
You are donuts. The worst token gay character ever.
No, that shit doesn't bother me. Heteronormity, the fact that there are, I'm not threatened by the fact that so many people are straight. You know, that there are more straight people than there are gay people. It doesn't particularly offend me. It really doesn't have anything to do with me.
Oh, so you mean you've accepted the fact that statistically there are many more straight people than there are gay people?
Yeah, it doesn't particularly bother me, and I don't feel oppressed for that. I feel much more oppressed as a capitalist, or as a romanticist, or as, you know, there are a lot of irrational egoists. There are a lot of other ways in which I could qualify as oppressed.
Yeah, I was totally kidding, but now you really are the worst gay character ever.
Elliot's all over here going, no one's shoving vagina down my throat, I don't care.
Yeah, it just doesn't bother me pretty much, you know. But there are, I mean, that's not to make light of, obviously. I mean, I'm here in the United States of America. I'm not in the Middle East where they'll decapitate me for being gay. So, I mean, it's partially because of the context of my life. You know?
Yeah, but not being able to see gay heroes is just as bad. Like, that's just as oppressive. It's just oppressive in a different way that you don't get. Yeah. Because you're part of the bourgeois.
Was that your Jim Gaffigan?
No, that was my hipster upstairs Austin room neighbor. That was his voice. You're just part of the bourgeois. You don't understand because you're bought into this capitalist bourgeoisie Randian system. He said that once.
He said Randian?
Yes.
Smack him.
He knew who Ayn Rand was and he hated her.
Justin, what about you?
I was waiting for someone to give me an intro. I've been carrying the weight here, guys. Thank you.
You're the host of the goddamn show.
It's your job.
Fucking carry the weight.
So, I mean, I think we mentioned it a lot on this podcast, but I think social pressure as to how to enjoy and create art, that there's so much pressure to just embrace naturalism, and that's the way it is. Especially because, and I don't talk about this often, but because I tutor. And that makes it very difficult to try and teach these kids, how do I reach these kids when their whole life they haven't been taught how to properly comprehend anything because they don't believe in objectivity and the artist's intentionality. So they don't see it as, this is a work that exists independent of you and exists in reality and you're just trying to understand it. They see it as, you know, your own feelings.
That's a good point.
Interesting.
I've never thought of you though with a comb over and giant frames, but I guess it was the first time for everything.
How do I reach these kids?
I mean, if he's advocating using the Bill Belichick method of cheating, I'm for it. Speaking of the influence of social pressures, what happens when fashion and Twitter combine? They make a non-crisis of the week. The headline on the Washington Post reads, Urban Outfitters apologizes for its blood-red stained Kent State sweatshirt. This is one of the most ridiculous stories I've ever seen. Get it or regret it, read the description for a vintage one-of-a-kind Kent State sweatshirt that Urban Outfitters briefly offered for just $129.
Shoot me. Oh my god.
Really? Really, dude? You said shoot me? Was that intentional?
All right. And we're canceled.
Internet canceled.
Did you say that on purpose?
I was channeling Joan Rivers all over again.
Okay, good, like, good. Like, as long as that wasn't intentional. If it's intentional, it's fine.
If you meant to offend people.
It was intentional, yes, it was.
I can't get mad if people are trying to offend people, but if they do it by accident, I'm just like, really?
God.
However, the fact that there was just
shoot me.
However, the fact that there was just one available for purchase is far from the most regrettable part of the item. The shirt was decorated with a blood splatter-like pattern, reminiscent of the 1970 Kent State massacre that left 4 people dead. The sweatshirt reported by BuzzFeed after a screenshot made the rounds on Twitter is now sold out, according to the site.
By the way, that sentence wouldn't have made sense to anyone even 10 years ago. The sweatshirt reported by BuzzFeed after a screenshot made the rounds on Twitter.
Well, to be fair, none of this makes any sense. It says the decorated with a blood spatter-like pattern reminiscent of the 1970 Kent State massacre. Interpreted literally, that means the blood spatter looks exactly like the blood spatter from Kent State. So what they mean is, it reminds people of blood spatter, which reminds people that people died at Kent State. But the way they wrote it is, it's exactly like the pattern from the Kent State one.
Yeah, this is a Morning Mix blog on Washington Post. Not their top writers, if you know what I mean. This is hilarious in the giant kerfuffle that it caused, including the guy who claims to have bought it and now has put it on eBay for $550.
Oh my god.
I think this is awesome. Danny, do either of you know what the Kent State Massacre is? Because I didn't, and I had to look it up.
Yeah, it was a Vietnam protest where they shot into the crowd and killed people.
Well, they, yeah. Specifically being the Ohio National Guard.
Right, it was government.
Yeah.
This was
just want to point that
deal.
Out, because I think many people sort of missed that point. It was the government who ordered shots fired.
I guess maybe this is just, once again, me not realizing my perspective. It kind of amazes me that you didn't know that. Like, that was, I don't know, it's just one of those things that I know and I remember.
Yeah, never heard about this in my entire life.
I mean, we learned about it in school, and then my dad always talks about it. My dad, who is very right-wing now, says when he was young, he was very anti the war and everything. But then he started seeing what he was very leftist, and then he saw like Kent State happen, and he realized the power the government had.
Right, as these As it's the irony of the protesters on college campuses yelling about wanting more socialism and stuff, and then like bigger government to stop all this the horrible corporations, and then these people with SWAT team uniforms come and mace them and beat them with sticks. Should be a giant arrow pointing above them that says "more government."
Right, and, that, SWAT and that's, guy. That's the thing about the Kent State massacre is this was the beginning of it, really, right? I mean, isn't this really the first time the American government fired on its own people, really?
Well, in the modern era, perhaps. But if you go back to post-revolutionary times, there's Whiskey Rebellion and numerous other incidences where the National Guard shot and killed citizens.
But can we talk about the bullshit? Can we talk about the bullshit apology here, by the way?
Oh, please. Yeah, please.
Let's see. As outrage spread, Urban Outfitters issued an apology for the product on Monday morning, claiming that the product was purchased as part of our sun-faded vintage collection. What collection? I thought there was only one. The company added that the bright red stains and holes, which certainly seemed to suggest blood, were simply discoloration from the original shade of the shirt, and the holes are from natural wear and fray. The statement added, "We deeply regret that this item was perceived negatively." Perceived negatively. Very interesting choice of words.
Yeah.
I'm just flabbergasted.
Crazy. I mean,
the fact that you guys didn't know about this means whoever made this literally did not know about the Kent State Massacre.
I believe it. I mean, this is not something that I was taught at all in school or in college or in grad school.
This blows my mind.
No, I knew about Kent State.
Much like an Ohio Guardsman.
I mean, really, weren't they just trying to stop the zombie apocalypse at Kent State?
Yeah, otherwise known as students at Kent State.
I have a
competing non-crisis of the week, by the way, because this was definitely a non-crisis. People made a huge deal out of this, and it's not that big a deal.
I don't know. I think it's kind of a big deal. People don't know about the Kent State Massacre.
Okay, well, now it's a real crisis of the week, you hypocrite.
Yeah, I'm changed here.
So I have an actual non-crisis of the week, which is Apple, as part of their new push on iTunes again, and there's going to be some new music products coming out very soon.
Yeah.
They decided to give every iTunes user the new U2 album for free.
Yeah.
And they pushed it to everyone's phone or iPad. But the key point to remember here is that they didn't push the album, like, it wasn't physically on your device. You just had free access to it through the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And people flipped their shit about receiving a free U2 album. Granted, U2 is fucking terrible. And their music is highly offensive based on how fucking terrible it is. But I'm not going to flip my lid over receiving free music. But people went to Twitter and just being like, this is an invasion of my privacy, man. This is like worse than the NSA. See, these evil corporations can get into your phone anytime they want and give you free shit.
Don't people go to Twitter over everything?
Yeah, they do.
Well, yeah.
You had the same reaction I had, Daniel, because I don't care. Like, if they're going to give me free music from the cloud, it doesn't particularly bother me. But why couldn't it have been, like, Muse or the Jezebels or a band that I would actually, like, really want to listen to? Why does it have to be
because
YouTube?
Because they don't need the stupid publicity to get people to listen to them.
I was just, you know, that was my only complaint. Like, really, why couldn't we have at least picked an album or something?
I'm going to turn this into a point of honor. I read the headline and I thought U2 was just doing this as a stupid publicity stunt. So I did not know about this, whereas you did not know about the Kent State Massacre. I win!
Points!
Indeed.
The points mean nothing, just like at midnight.
Oh. Wipe, 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 wipe.
All right.
All right, what did we learn this week, Daniel?
Over one thing. Learned about the goddamn Kent State University massacre. I think that's pretty profound and pretty big. I guess other than that, I learned that intersex characters are no more interesting to me than any other poorly written
character. Intersexing characters? No, doesn't work.
No, don't even. Just don't. You're a racist. Don't do it.
Elliot.
Well, God, my penis is God's penis, which means God's been inside quite a few assholes.
Oh, my penis. I was going to say God, but since it's interchangeable.
I was
going
to get slightly mad at that, but I was like, nah, he needs that. He needs to redeem himself as a gay character.
He needs to redeem himself. I don't know if, I want Drew to tell me if he knew about the Kent State Massacre, because maybe it's being taught in Canada and not here in America.
If so, Canada knows that, I don't know how I would feel. I think I would kind of lose my shit.
Over you too.
All right. And I learned that I need to open up a charity with Jimmy Carter called Domiciles for Divinity.
Oh, God. You don't need volunteers, you know?
I'm Justin M. Wisniewski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce. William Green?
Hey! You don't have to bleep out that name, but yes.
Do I?
Yes. I'm not allowed to give out full names on a podcast that goes out to a national-wide audience.
We can give out the first name.
Yeah, that's true.